heading in our direction. Now 67 degrees, Kenosha, 62 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And on this stormy, rainy day, I do appreciate that my faculty colleague from Carthage, Dr. Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science, has made his way to our studios to join me for our first conversation in actually quite some time, and a conversation that I think will have no shortage of talking points. These are really interesting times in which we live, especially for anybody who is in the political science business, teaching political science and trying to make sense of what is going on in our country right now, particularly at the highest levels of our government with this impeachment inquiry underway. So we're, without much further ado, going to get right into some really important topics and issues and questions. Professor Mast, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. It's always good to be here.
So, talk about these interesting times in which we live and in which you are teaching political science. What does it feel like for you professionally, as opposed to, let's say, 5 or 10 years ago? And what's going on in the classroom right now?
I guess you could say that today's weather is a bit of a metaphor for the political times and the challenges associated with trying to teach this. The Tuesday, Thursday, 2 p.m. students of American political American government would like a shout out. So I know that some of them are listening. Good morning, students. Do your homework this weekend. Enjoy homecoming, but don't enjoy it too much. It is a challenge in the sense that, we're watching very important developments in real time. And so the challenge of political science is to try to weed through a lot of kind of subjective opinion and describe what's happening in the political world as fairly and accurately as one can. And having a good deal of hindsight helps in that respect. And so when you're trying to analyze something in the moment, there's an enormous amount of uncertainty that comes into it. And when you're trying to make sense of the uncertainty as a political scientist, you have to kind of ask yourself, is my judgment of this uncertainty, am I trying to shed light here motivated by evidence and theoretical understanding that has kind of stood the test of peer review and the judgment of multiple scholars, or does it reflect your own kind of personal bias? And so I don't think that anyone can completely and totally ratchet out kind of personal feelings from the process of analysis. Scientists, social science, scientists or otherwise, are not robots. And so you're trying to make sense of a very complicated phenomenon. And, you have to make certain kinds of judgments that are a combination of both professional rigor, but also are going to, on some level, be the outcome of your own kind of natural reaction to it. And so you try to limit the latter and emphasize the former, and you know, be as humble as you can about what it is that you're saying.
Right. What about the pure and simple matter of fear and of being fearful of what is going on right now and what it might mean for our country and the uncertainty about exactly what is ahead of us? And for you as a teacher, how do you factor in that your own deep concerns, which I know you have, about where this could potentially lead us and so on? And what about your students? Are any of them, in a sense, frightened for the future of our democracy and our country in light of what's going on right now?
The short and easy and correct answer is yes. There are plenty of students who are worried about this. For a variety of reasons. And I think on some level, all citizens should feel that way. And I think do, actually. The level of anxiety in the country seems to be on the rise. And if you look at the survey data on public opinion and political perspectives, it's quite clear. Americans are worried and becoming more worried. And I think that in some sense, that's a good thing, because in a democratic society, fear can be a motivating factor to understanding, right? To try to better understand what it is that's going on, and an impetus to do something about it, to correct the problems. Fear is also dangerous in the sense that it can undermine trust. And so if you look at the way in which the two parties perceive each other, the Pew Research Center is an excellent organization that has been studying American public attitudes for a very long time, and they have done some really good work on polarization. They have a report out just this week, a new one on this, and unfortunately, it kind of verifies the ongoing trend of increasing animosity across the parties, and to the extent that big political parties view each other with animus, right? The their inability to trust each other gets worse, right? And so there is, in fact, interesting research on how democracies deteriorate and degrade, and fear within the electorate of each other is one of those things, because it motivates a willingness to tolerate undemocratic kinds of actions, so long as those undemocratic actions are perceived to be limiting the influence of those who are feared, right? And so fear is both potentially useful and potentially dangerous. And so, you know, trying to understand it as best we can, I think, is critically important. And that's how I approach it in the classroom. Let's try to understand, you know, the things that we're confronted with better than we, you know, have to this point.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Jerry Mast from the Political Science Faculty at Carthage College. So let's talk about the deeds that have landed President Trump in trouble. That is, deeds which have led to the beginning of this impeachment inquiry. And I want you to describe what he has done and what he has admitted to doing, and then maybe we can talk a little bit about how those actions are being, of course, deeply criticized, right, on the one side, and being, in a sense, defended or explained by the other side.
Right. Well, I mean, it seems that at the very beginning of this year, supporters of the president, including former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, began the process of reaching out to the Ukrainian government to influence the government in a direction that would result in the investigation of former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden. And then this summer, there was a point at which the president suspended the delivery of $400 million appropriated by Congress as aid to the Ukraine. The president ordered that money suspended. And then in a phone call with President Zelensky, President Trump, they discussed the aid that that Ukraine needed in its kind of ongoing conflict with Russia. President Trump said that, you know, the United States has been helpful to Ukraine in the past, but this has been a kind of a one-sided direction of help, and that he would like a favor, and that favor would be an investigation into Mr. Biden and his son. And so this has all been revealed by a whistleblower report. The White House has acknowledged that this conversation took place. A rough transcript of that conversation has been released by the White House. And so the argument, right, that that the president has engaged in something that may in fact be impeachable, right, centers on the pressuring of a foreign government to deliver something that would be useful to the president in the election, right? And so if we look at Title 52 of the U.S. Code, this is Section 301.121, it shall be unlawful for, it reads, the law reads, a foreign national directly or indirectly to make a contribution of or donation of money or anything of value, to make an express or implied promise to make a contribution or donation in a connection with a federal, state, or local election. It continues and says, it shall be unlawful for a person to solicit, accept, or receive a contribution or donation described above from a foreign national. So it is a violation of federal election law to solicit or accept support from a foreign national, let alone a foreign government, in a foreign election. So there's that, right? That's the kind of the real motivating concern on the part of the whistleblower and a number of other persons who were privy to the conversation at the time to reach out and express their concerns. And that's what's being investigated. So aside from the violation of the law, one might ask, why is it so bad, right, that someone would accept influence from a foreign national with respect to a federal election? And I think that if we reflect on this, we can see that there's a case that this is indeed really egregious and very bad indeed, right? Because elections are the mechanism by which the electorate expresses its will. To the extent that the American political system possesses popular sovereignty, it is through a legitimate and valid electoral process that possesses integrity. When foreign influences enter into the process to help determine the outcome of an election, then the popular sovereignty is diluted, right? The outcome is not so much a reflection of what the American electorate thinks, but the American electorate in combination with foreign influences.
What they want.
Right, and what they want. Their interests are not necessarily the same as ours. I think it would be foolish to assume that they are.
It'd be foolish to assume that Russia wants the best for the United
right.
States, or that China wants the best for the United States,
right.
Or whoever.
So worry about foreign intervention in American politics is long-standing. The founders spoke about it repeatedly. And the federal election law that I just cited is meant to try to limit that kind of influence, to make sure that our elections reflect really what we think rather than we and in combination with foreign sources.
Before we talk about the way in which these actions by Mr. Trump have been defended by his supporters, can you explain why President Trump has, at least on some occasions, spoken so openly about this? I mean, seemingly with no concern that what he did, that this phone call, for instance, represented anything illegal or out of bounds or unfortunate
right.
in any
right.
respect.
Right. In fact, he followed up assertions to that effect on the White House lawn with a call for China to investigate Joe Biden and Hunter Biden. So it seems to me that he either doesn't understand the argument that foreign influence over elections is bad, or he is judging that he can make the case that they're not with enough American voters. Now, he has argued different things at different times. At one point, he has argued that, this isn't about the election. This is about corruption, right? And so his defenders have picked up this line of argument and said that he's not guilty of violating Title 52 of the U.S. Code because the solicitation of an investigation into Joe and Hunter Biden isn't motivated by any desire to influence the election, but rather motivated by a desire to end corruption, right?
And the fact that Joe Biden is at the moment his chief political rival is then, in a sense, just a coincidence.
Well, that's what you have to accept, right? To follow this line of argument. And, the basis of is there any basis to worrying about the fact that the former vice president's son sits on a board of directors? I think yes, that raises some questions about the propriety, right? There's a really good piece this summer in July, I believe, from the New Yorker, looking at Hunter Biden, giving a kind of profile of who he is and whether or not he will have a negative impact on Joe Biden's pursuit of the Democratic nomination. And in that piece, the fairly lengthy piece discussing, the propriety of powerful the sons of powerful American political figures receiving positions of influence
that they would otherwise never get.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Is this something to worry about? And I think that the answer is yes. The article makes a reference to this characterization called corruption by proxy. That is to say, it is a kind of an indirect form of corruption that the people around powerful people somehow are given access to opportunities that other people are not. I think that what makes the profile of Hunter Biden in the New Yorker particularly interesting is that Hunter Biden himself is an interesting person. Is he unqualified to serve as on the board of directors to this natural gas operation in the Ukraine? It's not clear to me that he is unqualified. He had a degree from Georgetown, a law degree from Yale. He worked for MBNA, the bank, rising to the level of vice president. He left that to work in the Commerce Department under Bill Clinton, doing policy analysis and promotion. He did work as a lobbyist together with a couple of other people, including John Kerry's stepson. He started a consultancy that did international kind of business consulting. So, it's not like there's nothing on his resume. Now, does that mean that he would have gotten that position if he weren't, the son of the vice president of the United States? No, I doubt that, right? I mean, I think that the connection to his father, very important and open doors, but it's a complicated situation.
Sure. Well, there are complicated situations all over the world and all kinds of points of potential corruption or questionable practices and right. So on. But of all of those, for the president to be bringing the State Department and the Department of Justice into this effort specifically for Joe Biden and Hunter Biden, I mean, right. Why this particular
right.
point?
That's the important question. And if you look at the administration track record outside of this, I mean, it's pretty thin with respect to trying to stop corruption. There
right.
doesn't seem to be any concerted effort to increase the executive branch's efforts to stifle corruption. In fact, one of President Trump's first acts as president was to sign into law a bill that rescinded rules on the oil industry in terms of reporting their donations to foreign governments, which was meant to limit or slow down or make corruption less likely. So, at some point, Americans have to kind of judge the plausibility of some of these claims.
And who is to benefit from such an investigation? I mean, do we as a country benefit from Joe and Hunter Biden being investigated, or does the president politically benefit from such an investigation?
Right. So the claims on the part of the president or his defenders that this has nothing to do with influencing the 2020 election, that it is really just about corruption, don't strike me at this point as particularly credible.
One of the challenges for those who support President Trump and believe that he has either done nothing wrong or nothing that rises to the level of being impeachable is, in a sense, shifting defenses. And you've already touched on the fact that the president himself has shifted ground a little bit in the way that he has characterized what he did and why it is not wrong or not impeachable or right. So on. And so his defenders are in an uncomfortable position as well because of that shifting ground.
Yeah, I think that this is a real challenge to working for President Trump and working with him, and his willingness to shift, his willingness to take a line of argument that deviates from what he's done before, his refusal to kind of lay out a larger vision predicated in policy objectives or political principles and so forth, all make it difficult to know exactly what it is you're trying to defend other than the man himself. And so that is a real challenge.
One of the important points here is how the American public is viewing all of this. And ahead of us talking about what is going to likely unfold in terms of the impeachment inquiry itself and what has already unfolded, let's talk for a moment about the fact that there seems to be an increasing number of American people, including people who are more to the right than the left, who seem to have serious misgivings about what the president has done and who support an impeachment inquiry, and a rising number of people who are already feeling like even impeachment and removal from office is what they would like to see. First of all, maybe you can help us understand just how significant a shift are we seeing,
right.
And why are we seeing this kind of movement now versus nearly no movement at all in other controversies that have dogged the president before this? Why is this moving the needle on a public opinion so dramatically?
Yeah, Republican pollster and political analyst Whit Ayers said this a few weeks ago. I think he's right that a lot of this is mostly going to hinge on the attitudes of a relatively small sliver of the public who are have been in the last several years, excuse me, opposed to impeachment, but not supportive of the president. And so, President Trump's approval numbers have been fairly consistent in the low 40s, but support for impeachment kind of mirrors that, right? So there has not been support for impeachment higher than the low 40s. And so what that means is there are some people, right, who disapprove of the president but don't support impeachment. And what happens to their view of all of this may really have big impacts on the outcome of a Senate trial. And, you know, the what we've seen in just this past week is that the percentage of Americans supporting the inquiry and impeachment and removal has shot up by, you know, upwards of 10-12%. Fox News poll this week reported the number of American voters, registered voters, who support impeachment and removal, they found it to be 51%, with, of course, the standard margin of error applying. So is it a majority? It's not clear, but it's close if it isn't.
And it's certainly a bigger number than we have ever seen before.
Correct, right. And so the overall distribution of opinion on this is fluid. It's dynamic. It's moving. And it's not moving right now in a direction supporting the president in this regard.
Right. And what is your best guess on why this issue is galvanizing this movement of a public opinion, unlike any controversies before?
Well, the fact that there are all these other controversies may matter, right? So maybe this is a straw that is breaking a weakened back. I don't know that for sure, but certainly makes a certain amount of sense. I guess let's compare it to the issues that the Mueller investigation looked at, right? So the Mueller investigation looked into the influence of Russian authorities on the 2016 election. And what the Mueller report concluded was that the Russians did try to influence the election, that they tried to influence on behalf of President Trump, that the Trump campaign met multiple times with various Russian proxies. But there wasn't enough evidence to establish that the president actively solicited their help. And so, you know, they said that, you know, there could – they didn't find a case to be made that the president solicited or colluded with Russians to help sway the outcome of the election. Nonetheless, right, that's not an exoneration, right? There was a foreign government that tried to influence the 2016 election, and the Trump campaign knew about it, right? That the fact that the Mueller investigation resulted in what is fairly damning information for the president, right? They laid out a number of instances in which it seems that the president tried to obstruct the investigation into Russian interference, but noted that there is this Department of Justice rule that sitting presidents shall not be indicted, and so they didn't, you know, recommend indictment because there's this rule that prohibits it. The fact that the Mueller report came out, right, illustrating a fair number of disturbing things about the Trump administration and yet resulted in no kind of legal consequence to the president left, I think, a fair number of Americans confused and bewildered, right? And so when the Ukrainian issue comes up, right, here we have what appears to be a fair amount of evidence that the president did, in fact, solicit in involvement on the part of a foreign government into the upcoming presidential election. And the president himself has acknowledged that he had this conversation, right? And so all of a sudden, the case that the president has run afoul of federal election law and sought foreign interference becomes much stronger than it was with respect to the Russian situation.
What's interesting to me is how the president reached out to Ukraine, which on the surface would seem to have everything to do with 2020, in some respects seems to have nearly as much to do with 2016. That is the possibility of trying to create a case in which that interference in 2016 actually was not from the Russians,
right,
but was in fact from Ukraine, and that this has all been an elaborate sort of framing sort of enterprise. But that's really an intriguing possibility here because it points to what I think a lot of people have acknowledged as the president's preoccupation with this entire charge that he won in 2016 because of Russian interference. And I think a persuasive case can be made that he might very well have won that election anyway without that Russian interference, but that somehow taints his victory in a way that he really finds unacceptable.
I think that's very true, right? I mean, it's not just the taint of foreign interference. He lost the popular vote, right? And so he's tried to delegitimize the popular vote by describing that outcome as the reflection of illegal aliens voting improperly in the election. So, yeah, I think he is very much motivated to recast this Russian involvement story as a hoax, right? It's all made up. When you know the National Security Agency, the CIA, a number of intelligence agencies have looked into this and concluded, right, that it was in fact Russia, and the fact that the president is pushing a line of argument very much in contrast to the intelligence community is itself a fairly you know, controversial, one might once upon a time call it scandalous, thing. And so the president may, in fact, be very much motivated for vindication in that angle of it as well.
Right. One difficulty that President Trump is facing right now, it seems to me, is not just the defection of a number of his supporters just in the population in terms of the poll numbers that you just cited, that there seem to be a increasing number of Americans who have grave misgivings about what the president has done in this instance. But there also seem to be instances in which there are also, even within the government, people that are defecting. I'm not talking about necessarily diehard supporters of President Trump on Capitol Hill, but more people who, within the government,
right,
who seem to be increasingly willing to air grievances or reveal difficult realities. Can you just speak to that?
Yeah, well, I think that this pulls into the conversation these conspiracy theories about the deep state, right? That there is this kind of well coordinated cabal of bureaucrats that are running things, and that they're somehow undermining democracy by trying to cancel the 2016 election, but by resisting President Trump. And I think that is a wild overstatement of the situation. What is true about the executive branch, right, is that every president is surrounded by White House staff that they hire, and the White House staff have a loyalty to the president who hires them. That's true of every president.
The man or woman who is president.
Correct.
At the time.
Their loyalties lie with the president. But the since World War II, the professional office of the executive has evolved, and there are many people who work for the president. In the Office of Management and Budget, the National Security Council are two kind of high-profile examples, but there's really many people who are career civil servants working in the executive branch, and their loyalty is to the office of the presidency. And there's a real difference between the presidency and any given president, right? And so when you're an intelligence officer sitting in on a phone call, which is, you know, standard protocol, listening to the president engage in a conversation with a foreign head of state, you have some loyalties to the president, but your paramount loyalty is to the Constitution and to the presidency. And so what seems to be the case, right, is that a number of these people who were privy to this phone call heard things that they found disturbing and alarming and inconsistent with proper behavior in a president. And so by reaching out and contacting somebody in apparently the Central Intelligence Agency, who then wrote a report based on multiple sources who communicated with him or her, right, filed this report with the Intelligence Community Inspector General. So that's kind of how all of this came about. And President Trump and his defenders are very frustrated with the executive branch, in a sense that there are a number of people who feel that the president is deviating from norms and traditions, and at times, right, as the Ukraine scenario illustrates, deviating from the public interest.
You wonder if this is for somebody who has never held political office before of any kind at any level, you wonder if that kind of distinction is probably difficult for somebody like Donald Trump, who has always been in the world of business and pretty much always been the boss. And that just means something very, very different than it means to be the president of the United States and head of this really complicated government along with all of its checks and balances. That must seem like a very foreign landscape to him.
Correct. And I think that's a super important point. And I think that when the dust settles on the kind of the historical analysis of President Trump and his presidency, they're going to find that this has been one of the factors explaining why he's done some of the things he's done. That is to say, when one occupies a role in which you have responsibilities to represent both, you know, multiple other people and institutions, right? That requires a certain amount of thinking and action that is distinct from what you would do as a private individual. So whether you're, you know, a department chair at a college or the Senate chair at a college or the shop steward at a factory, right? You may have your own personal opinions, and your own personal opinions may, in fact, influence what you decide to say and do. But you also have to take into account other perspectives, other interests, and give them their due, right? In thinking about what it is that you say and the actions that you take. And I think that one of the roles of the presidency that Mr. Trump doesn't quite understand well enough is this role of chief of state. The chief of state means that he is the president for everybody, and that involves taking into account the opinions not just of those who support you fervently, but the opinions of those who don't support you, and being honest about what their perspectives are, and trying to seriously and honestly take into account what they think, so that they may not agree with the things that you say and do, but they feel like their opinions still in some sense are legitimate and they matter to their government. Because it is everybody's government.
We're speaking with Dr. Jerry Mast from the Political Science Faculty at Carthage College as we enter our last quarter of this program. We should talk about the nature of this impeachment inquiry that is currently underway. And it's really interesting also that Speaker Nancy Pelosi was feeling intense pressure from certain quarters of her party to begin an impeachment inquiry long before this. But she chose this moment. And I think a number of people, even some who have often criticized her, are seeing maybe now that there was some wisdom in waiting for this moment and for this particular matter to be revealed to begin impeachment.
Right. I mean, it's important to remember that impeachment is a political tool, right? It is a political act. And by political, I don't mean partisan. I mean it has impact and consequences for everybody, for all of the entire nation. Let's just reflect really briefly on what Alexander Hamilton had to say about the purpose of impeachment. Hamilton said that impeachment exists for those offenses which proceed from the misconduct of public men, or in other words, from the abuse and violation of some public trust. They are of a nature which may, with peculiar propriety, be denominated political, as they relate chiefly to injuries done immediately to society itself. And so what Hamilton is saying there is that impeachment is designed for the misuse of the office, for abuse of power. That can involve illegal activity, but it doesn't necessarily have to involve illegal activity, and not all illegal activity has to rise to the level of abuse of power or misuse of authority in the office. And so there's that. And I think Ms. Pelosi understands, right, that on some level the case against President Trump with respect to impeachment has to rest on this idea of abusing the office, abusing power. And she's been really hesitant to move on this, I believe, because she doesn't see enough hope that the political case can be made to the American electorate overall. Now, she's come under a great deal of criticism within her own party over this, right? And in fact, in the week prior, just to her announcement that impeachment inquiry would begin, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was on National Public Radio in an interview in which, you know, she said that the Democrats' refusal to impeach the president is in some ways worse than the abuse of the office that the president deserves impeachment for, right? Mm. So she was very much leveling her sights on the speaker for this kind of reticence. And, you know, I think that that's an indication, right, of conflict within the Democratic Party over this very thing, right? One of the things that my classes are discussing and examining is what is the impact of polarization on the parties themselves. And one of the impacts of polarization on the parties themselves is that they become more homogenous internally, right? So the Republican Party is becoming more consistently conservative. The Democratic Party is becoming more consistently liberal, right? So that's happening for sure. But because that's happening, we shouldn't assume that there aren't deep and significant conflicts within the parties themselves, which there definitely are.
Yeah, we're seeing right that, now. Aren't we? And on both sides.
On both
in
sides.
Some ways, yeah. Of course, one of the things that is making now all of this seem even more dramatic and also a little more unpredictable in terms of where all this is going is the letter that was sent. I don't remember if it was sent to Speaker Pelosi or to Adam Schiff or
both of them, I believe.
Okay, but a letter from a White House lawyer basically saying that the president and those closest to him are refusing to cooperate and do not intend to participate in this impeachment process. What do you suspect is behind that decision that they have made? A decision which, of course, among other things, leads them potentially open to further charges of obstruction of justice, which is a really serious matter.
Right. I think their position is, in fact, handing over another article of impeachment, right? And given that it is, and let's remember that one of the articles of impeachment being drawn up against President Nixon was obstruction of Congress, right? So this is very much in keeping with that. Now, why? They take this route? I mean, I don't know the answer, but I think that it's logical to assume that it's the result of some political calculus, that taking this approach of kind of stonewalling the Congress on this is less damaging than cooperating with the Congress will be, right? So, you know, it raises the question, well, there must be something that they have to hide that they don't want to come out that cooperation would, in fact, shed light on. It's a gamble, right, that by casting impeachment as illegitimate, there will be sufficient numbers of Republicans who refuse to support it so that there will be fewer than 20 Republican senators in the Senate who will vote to convict. It seems to me a fairly desperate gambit with respect to the kind of the political fallout for the country as a whole, but one that actually might work because while I think impeachment is almost certainly going to happen in the House. The votes are there. There certainly seems enough evidence that's already been exposed to warrant it. Whether or not that will result in removal from the office in the Senate, that is a much, much, much more uncertain kind of outcome. In fact, it seems unlikely to me.
Right. What about the possibility that has been raised that there might actually be an impeachment inquiry as well for instance, Attorney General William Barr? First of all, is that something that the House can do? Can they impeach the Attorney General as readily as they could potentially impeach the president himself? And how unprecedented would that be?
Well, they sure can impeach him if they choose to try to do so. And again, the grounds for doing so would be their judgment that he has abused the responsibilities of his office. It's a misuse of his office, abusing power, and so forth. Attorney generals are supposed to, you know, execute the law faithfully as the law says. And if an attorney general fails to execute the law faithfully, instead works on behalf of a president, something that we can note President Trump has asked for when he is attorney general was attorney general, a previous attorney general, then yeah, I mean, there's a case to be made that the attorney general is misusing the powers of his office. Does it happen very often? No, it's very rare. Although in 1992, the House impeached and the Senate removed a federal judge, a judge who happened to be named Nixon, Walter Nixon. And in that case, Judge Nixon sued the government by arguing that the Senate failed to give him due process by stating that it was only a committee of the Senate that voted to remove him, not the whole Senate. His argument is the whole Senate's required to do so. And the Supreme Court argued that the powers of impeachment and the processes of impeachment are solely up to the House to decide, and that the powers and processes of conviction are solely the possession of the Senate to figure out, and that it's not the role of the courts to tell them that they have to do this or that. And so the letter that the White House counsel sent to Ms. Pelosi and Mr. Schiff, kind of complaining about a lack of due process on the part of the House with respect to not holding a vote to begin the impeachment inquiry, by not giving the president due process associated with the rights of the accused, the right to cross-examine witnesses, to call witnesses, and so forth. None of those things are a requirement of impeachment, right? So the Constitution is very vague on this. The House has the powers of impeachment. The House will figure out what that entails. There are no rules of the House that they have to hold a vote in this regard. And so this idea of due process with respect to the courts having the authority to intervene and insist upon it, there's not a good case, not a good legal case anyway, that the House is in violation of any of that.
And of course, we haven't even touched on the fact that I've heard at least a few voices calling for the impeachment of Vice President Mike Pence as well. It's really amazing to kind of think about those scenarios. Not that that is necessarily likely, but
yeah, no, I see that as unlikely for sure.
In a minute or so, what do you think the Democrats and Speaker Pelosi and Chairman Adam Schiff should be thinking about in terms of how they proceed with this investigation? What sort of political considerations do you suspect they are weighing?
Well, there's a debate right now within the Democratic caucus over whether or not they should hold a vote to formally endorse an impeachment inquiry in response to the White House's charge that they didn't do it. So I guess I think that one of the things they're going to have to and should think about is how much involvement they want to give the Republicans in the House in this inquiry. Do they want to give the Republicans the opportunity to issue subpoenas, to call witnesses, and so forth? How open do they want to make that? That's an important consideration.
Among many. Right. And with that, we draw to this conclusion, this conversation to an end. But I am so appreciative of you taking time out of, I know it is a really, really busy schedule, to offer your thoughts and perspectives on all of these matters. And I have to say, I wish I was a fly on the wall for some of your classes, because I have a feeling some of what happens in those classrooms is really interesting right now.
Yeah, I think that young people are concerned, worried, and
paying attention,
and yeah, increasingly so. So
there's one positive.
There's one positive
in a largely messy situation. Dr. Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science, thank you again for being part of the morning show today.
Well, my pleasure, Craig.
On Monday, we have a very special morning show planned with a renowned painter by the name of Dan Simino, who has an enormous exhibit of his work about to open at a gallery in Grays Lake, Illinois. And it's going to be an opportunity to talk with him about the fine art of painting in really great detail. We remind you that The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. It's now available as a podcast on all the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and The Morning Show is available 7 days a week. The broadcast version, of course, Monday through Friday, and morning shows out of the archives on Saturday and Sunday. Please subscribe. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. WGTD is supported by the Metropolitan Opera, whose next high-definition simulcast schedule and season opens tomorrow afternoon.